Hey guys, it is Ryan. I'm not sure if you know this about me, but I'm a bit of a fun fanatic when I can. I like to work, but I like fun too. It's a thing. And now the truth is out there. I can tell you about my favorite place to have fun. Chumba Casino. They have hundreds of social casino style games to choose from with new games released each week. You can play for free anytime, anywhere. And each day brings a new chance to collect daily bonuses. So join me in the fun. Sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to the Pelvic Messenger, the show that dives into the world of chronic pelvic pain. The Pelvic Messenger brings to you a fair and balanced message of hope. Empower yourself with the knowledge, understanding, and tools to best manage your pelvic problems and pain. My own personal struggles with endometriosis, interstitial cystitis, and pelvic floor dysfunction have led me to be an advocate and a voice for all of the diseases, syndromes, and complexities of the pelvis. It is with great empathy and compassion that I bring this show to you. Enjoy the next hour, and together let us learn and inspire one another. Together we can create real and lasting change. The content of this show and the website for Pelvic Messenger are for informational purposes only and are not a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Always seek the advice of your physician or other qualified healthcare provider with any questions you may have regarding concerns and medical conditions.
Hi, and welcome to the first of a two-part show titled Nutrition for Endometriosis. My name is Lori Houghton, and I will be your pelvic messenger today, broadcasting live from Ottawa, Canada's capital city. You'll have to excuse me, I do have a bit of a cold, so if I sound a little bit raspy, that's why. Now, this topic today is very near and dear to me. When I was first diagnosed with endometriosis, I had heard about the endo diet and the diet-endo connection shortly after, and that was back in 2006. But it wasn't actually until the fall of 2010 that the idea that the foods that I was putting into my body were actually causing me to hurt more than I actually needed to. My story is pretty simple. I saw a new endometriosis specialist, and he asked me to follow a strict macrobiotic diet for 4 weeks to allow my body to fully detox, and then to go back to my normal eating habits. Well, by the end of those 4 weeks, I found myself away from home, manning a booth at a trade show, and the aha moment came to me after a friend that was also exhibiting at the show brought me over my favorite latte. Now, I'd been 28 days without any dairy or any caffeine, and so I was thrilled to have this latte. But then within 10 minutes of consuming that thing, my body was in full revolt. This was 8:30 a.m., and I had to be there working in my booth till 10 p.m. that night. It was the longest, most painful and exhausting and frustrating day that I had ever experienced, because I knew that the reason why my body was in so much pain was because of something simple that I had done by drinking something that I shouldn't have. So that's my story. That is the reason why I believe so strongly that what we eat can help with our endometriosis symptoms. And here to help us understand today the endo-diet connection is Danielle Cook, MSRD-CDE, functional medicine nutritionist from the Vital Health Institute in Los Gatos, California. Today she will discuss with us some of the basic theories for endo and the contributing factors, how diet can help or worsen someone's symptoms, and some diets that are out there. Now, our next show that is in this series is scheduled for May 15th, and we ask you to please mark that on your calendar and to tune in. We'll be discussing some actual recommendations on how that can help control your endo flares through diet and provide you with some actual tools to help you with your diet and your lifestyle, to help modify your eating habits in order to increase your quality of life. So let me tell you a little bit about Danielle. She has a master's degree in nutrition and food science and has a diverse background in the field of nutrition. She has worked as an inpatient clinician dietitian, as a nutrition support specialist specializing in tube feeding and intravenous feeding, and a diabetes educator dietitian in an outpatient setting. She also teaches classes at the university level, including nutrition, upper-level metabolism, environmental and world hunger, and a graduate of dietetics. In addition to her nutrition background, she has also worked as a personal trainer for 9 years and studied exercise physiology. After contracting an illness while traveling, Danielle sought out several modalities of medicine in her journey back to wellness. She became very frustrated with the conventional allopathic medical system and watched her health quickly decline despite seeking out the best specialist in the Western medicine. On this journey, she discovered functional medicine. It was the piece to the puzzle that had helped her start to regain her health and wellness. Danielle now specializes in functional preventative nutrition. Good afternoon, Danielle. Good morning for you there in California. Danielle, could you please explain to our listeners what functional medicine is and how you got into it?
Sure, absolutely. Good morning and good afternoon. Thanks for having me. It's exciting. It's fun. So functional medicine is more of a holistic, individualized approach. And so I guess I can give a scenario. So let's say somebody comes into our office and they're complaining of heartburn. A typical Western medicine treatment would be to put that person on what's called a proton pump inhibitor, acid blocker, and that would decrease the amount of acid in their stomach so that when they do reflux, which they're going to continue to reflux, it's just less acidic, so it's not going to cause that burning pain in their esophagus anymore.
Mm.
In medicine, what we would do is we would try to figure out, why does this person have heartburn? Do they have heartburn because they don't chew their food very well and they're not starting off that digestive process? Do they have heartburn because they have food sensitivities and they've got inflammation throughout their digestive tract? Do they have heartburn because they have a little infection in there, maybe a candida infection that's causing gas formation further down in their intestine? So what we try to do is assess what the root cause of that problem is,
right,
and then start there in our treatment. And it's kind of an evolving concept, which a lot more physicians, a lot more medical practitioners are starting to kind of wrap their heads around and integrate into their practices.
Right.
So it's really exciting. It's a neat movement to be a part of, and you really do get to see the effectiveness of this. Sometimes, you know, it's hit or miss. You know, we start somewhere and we've got to explore another area, and what's called practicing medicine. But it's nice because we can really individualize our treatment and really get at what's causing this person's discomfort.
Excellent. So, Danielle, would you say that it's safe to say that functional medicine actually involves the patient in their own health care, empowering them and offering them tools to look after themselves better?
Absolutely. And our first appointment, or my first appointment when someone comes in through my door, is about an hour and a half, 2 hours long, and they fill out about a 20-page questionnaire, which goes all the way back to in utero. I want to know who's sitting in front of me, how they got to where they are right now. So, you know, what was their mother's pregnancy like? Were they breastfed? What was their diet like when they were a kid?
Right.
What was their health like when they were a kid? And I want to hear their story, because 9 times out of 10, someone, when they come into my office, they're going to tell me what's wrong with them. They're
right.
Probably going to tell me their diagnosis, if you want to say diagnosis. And if I just can listen, then I can, you know, really start to figure out, okay, how do they get from point A to point B, and where they're at right now when they're sitting in front of me, and try to unravel that and go really upstream and figure out how did it all start, and then we can start to unravel it. And if we can get towards that root cause, then together we can form a plan that's going to work for this person and start to move into a direction of better health. So really, it's not about me. It's about, okay, what's this person telling me, this individual in front of me, with their cluster or maybe it's just one symptom, and how do they feel about that? How do they feel about their health and what's their motivation like? And so it's not just giving them a pill for their ill. It's finding out, what do you want to do to fix your health right now? And let's look at the options, and then let's make a plan together.
That is excellent. You know, we talk a lot on Pelvic Messenger about empowerment through education and understanding what's going on in your body. And to most of us here that host these shows, we all agree that, you know, not only understanding and being part of your healthcare plan, not only is it going to help you physically with your symptoms, but it also helps strengthen you emotionally and mentally in dealing with these chronic diseases, no matter whether it's endometriosis or anything, you know, that is a chronic illness that you're going through. So, you know, obviously going to a practitioner such as yourself and adding them to your team is going to be a big part in not only understanding what it is that we're doing in our environment, in our lifestyle, that's affecting our health and well-being, but also figuring out ways that we can modify that. So on that note, I am so glad that you're here with us, Danielle. And so let's kind of go into the meat of this topic. Let's go back to the beginning to help those who are maybe still just trying to understand their disease or struggling to figure out why this has happened to them. So let's talk about some of the foundation things that science has told us about endometriosis.
So, yeah, and I don't proclaim myself to be a specialist in endometriosis per se, you know, an expert in endometriosis. That's where I lean heavily on Dr. Cook.
Right.
So the way I look at everything is, again, just that individual body and that holistic system and how it's all working together. And so I as far as, you know, endometriosis, you know, there's a lot of theories out there about how it happens in the body. And, you know, the most heavily believed is the retrograde menstruation, and that's where, you know, you have this kind of reflux of when you're having a cycle that goes back up and into your system. And so it's going to carry, you know, go back into your fallopian tubes, and it's going to, and that tissue can deposit and then grow.
Right.
So what I want to talk about more is some of these other things that are out there. There seems to be, it looks like, some sort of genetic predisposition in a lot of individuals that develop endometriosis. The way I think about genetics, and I'm not an expert in genetics, but the way I think about it is we all come into this world and we were born with our individual genetics.
Right.
And we might have a predisposition towards heart disease or a strong family history of cancer.
Mm-hmm.
So we kind of have this genetic makeup, and I kind of think of that as being like a loaded gun.
Right.
And then we have our environment and what we do in that environment. So what are we eating? What's our stress level like? Are we exercising? What kind of environmental pollutants are we interfacing with?
Mm-hmm.
And I kind of think that as being like if we're eating the wrong things or not exercising or we're exposed to a lot of different environmental pollutants, that's kind of like pulling the trigger
right. To
setting off those genes that we're already predisposed to. And so that's known as epigenetics. And basically we have our genetics, and then that's how our genes are expressing themselves depending on what the environment is that we're exposing them to. And so with endometriosis or any health condition, if you're overexposing your body to a lot of pollutants, a lot of toxins, and that could be toxins that from the inside of your body. So, for instance, endotoxins. So, for example, if you have a candida overgrowth, so yeast overgrowth in your gut, that's going to create a lot of different toxins, and a lot of them are neurotoxic and very inflammatory.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's going to overburden your body's system, and it's going to overburden your liver. And I want to talk a little bit about the liver as well. I don't know if we need to do it now or I can talk about it afterwards. But But that's a really important component in, you know, chronic disease prevention, endometriosis, symptom relief, and just keeping that inflammation down.
Certainly.
It's a really important organ.
Excellent. Well, let's jump in right into that then. You know, obviously the only thing we as patients can really control as far as our health and taking care of ourselves is our environment, the things that we expose ourselves to, the type of activities that we involve ourselves in, and those obviously are going to impact our overall health. But let's talk about those specifically and then bring in how the body reacts to that. So talking specifically about the liver.
Okay, sure. So I'll just kind of mention a couple toxins out there.
Mm-hmm.
One of them is dioxins, and this is just an environmental pollutant. The thing about dioxins is they accumulate in the fatty tissue of animals. And so most of our exposure to dioxins is through food. And so you're not going to find dioxins in vegetables. It's going to, because it's accumulating in that fatty tissue and in animal tissue. So if you're eating a lot of fatty meat products,
right,
a lot of dairy products, fish, shellfish, that takes in these dioxins and then stores that in their fat tissues, then you're going to be ingesting a lot of these dioxins. And when we talk about diets a little bit, we can kind of swing back to this.
Right.
but, you know, as far as milk, whether it be a mother's milk going to her baby, her infant, or us drinking cow's milk, we have a lot of fat tissue in our breasts. I mean, most of your breast tissue is fat tissue. And so
right.
you can imagine a lot of those toxins are going to accumulate in that breast tissue.
Mm-hmm.
And it's going to, and that breast tissue is also where milk is made.
Right.
And so that a lot of those toxins are going to come out through the milk. And so that's one thing to kind of keep in the back of your mind when we talk a little bit about some of these dietary recommendations. Some other toxins out there that we're exposed to environmentally that I think are worth mentioning in relation to endometriosis are what's called xenoestrogens.
Mm-hmm.
Xenoestrogens are, they can either be synthetic or they can be natural.
Okay.
And I'm going to just talk about xenoestrogens, the synthetic ones first. But
okay.
They're used in industrial compounds like PCBs, BPA, phthalates. And what they do is they have an estrogenic effect. So they'll actually bind to the estrogen receptor, but they're going to have a different effect on than estrogen is. That
okay.
Our bodies are not, and anything foreign that you're putting into your body, whether it be a chemical that your body doesn't recognize, whether it be a food, a chemical in your food that your body doesn't recognize, so like a trans fat or a hydrogenated fat,
right.
Your body is going to kind of say, what is this? And it's going to react differently.
Right.
And so these are going to definitely cause kind of an estrogen effect, but a different effect.
Okay.
Natural xenoestrogens are what are called phytoestrogens, and you've probably heard about these because these are plant-derived xenoestrogens.
Right.
And
right.
So these are kind of controversial, but a lot of foods have xenoestrogens. So apples have xenoestrogens. One of the foods that we think about that has high amounts of xenoestrogens is soy.
Right.
And soy we'll talk about in a little bit. I know we want to talk about that later on because I know that's kind of a controversial subject.
It is a hot topic within the endo community.
Yeah. And I have some thoughts on that. Yeah, flaxseed is also a little bit higher in xenoestrogens, but
mm-hmm.
And phytoestrogens, I'm sorry, but what phytoestrogens do is when we talk about estrogen, we think more about its effect that it's having on the body and also the duration of the effect that it's having on the body. So phytoestrogens are broken down and your body gets rid of them pretty quickly.
Okay.
Phytoestrogens are also going to sit on that receptor, the estrogen receptor, but they're going to have a weaker effect.
Okay.
And it's thought on a woman's hormone. So it's thought that phytoestrogens can actually be protective against things like breast cancer and possibly even with endometriosis.
Interesting.
I want to, yeah. And so what I usually tell people as far as their phytoestrogens is, you know, soy might not be okay because it has such a large amount of phytoestrogens in it. It might not be the best food. However, maybe small amounts in the diet might be okay. But drinking soy milk every single day probably isn't the best thing. And it's also really hard to digest soy. I guess I'm going to jump right into soy right now. Sorry.
Yeah, that would be great, yeah.
It's also really hard to digest. And so a lot of patients that I see with endometriosis, and a lot of our patients that come into our office do have some gastrointestinal discomfort. And so if you're putting something in your body that's really hard to digest, then you're going to just put a greater burden on that system that's already struggling.
Right.
And you know, there's different types of soy. There's fermented soys and non-fermented soys. So an example of a fermented soy would be, you know, miso or tempeh.
Right.
And those seem to be a lot easier to digest because they've already got bacteria in there. They're already helping that digestive process along.
Okay.
Whereas if you're eating tofu or soy milk, that's going to be a lot harder to digest. There's also a lot of chemicals that get added. And then I'm going to talk about a GMO diet or non-GMO diet later on so that I can get back to this a little bit. But soy is one of the foods in the food industry that's been pretty highly adulterated and genetically modified.
Right.
That's another reason I tell people to be careful with soy.
And it seems to be in everything. Like when you read the labels, there's always at least some sort of trace amount of soy in there. So it's really frustrating when you're shopping at the grocery store.
It is. And so, you know, I have a lot of people do an elimination diet when they come in to see me just to rule out food sensitivities. And, you know, it's hard. One of the things we eliminate is soy. And, you know, usually what I tell them is the easiest thing to do is try to get away from processed food as much as you can.
Right.
And when you are looking at foods, and we'll talk about this more next week when we talk, is, you know, trying to find a food with as few ingredients as possible in it and hopefully you can pronounce all of them. And I usually try to, you know, limit it to, you know, less than, you know, 5 ingredients or less.
Excellent.
Yeah, so, and that's just kind of a general rule.
That's great. So when you're talking about it being hard to break down, can you go over a little bit of maybe the mechanics of the body so that our listeners kind of understand the process of what happens to our food and why what we eat is actually so detrimental to our health?
Sure, yeah. I mean, steer me if I'm going in the wrong direction for what you're asking. When we start off our digestive process, the digestive process is going to start off in our mouth with our chewing.
Mm-hmm.
And that, I think, gets forgotten so much. And people tend to be doing a million things while they're eating.
Right.
And they don't chew their food. You know, I generally recommend chewing your every single bite, like 30 to 20 times, until it's a liquid, it's totally unrecognizable in your mouth.
Right.
And that really starts the digestive process. Then it's going to go down into your stomach. And then in your stomach, it's really important to have adequate stomach acid or hydrochloric acid. And what we see with a lot of people that with chronic health conditions, people that are under a lot of stress, is they actually have too little stomach acid, that stomach acid is really important for a couple of reasons. One, if you think of our immune system, about 70-80% of the immune system is in your gut.
Right.
And so that front line of that army, that immune system, is that hydrochloric acid. That's going to kill a lot of pathogens that come into our intestines. And our intestines really are outside of our body. So we really, you know, want to have that front line intact there. The other thing that hydrochloric acid does is it unwinds and unravels and starts to denature proteins. And so if you don't have enough stomach acid in there, what happens is those proteins don't get that first run at digestion started.
Right.
And we need to unravel those and denature them so that the enzymes can get at our proteins and start to pluck off what are called amino acids. And amino acids just make up, you know, a long chain of them make up proteins. And so when we absorb protein as we get further down into our digestive tract, and most of that absorption is going to take place in our small intestine, we can only really absorb our proteins that our body can recognize in these individual amino acids, or maybe a couple of them put together.
Right.
So if we don't get that first run at digestion taking place, what happens is some of those proteins stay intact, and then they get absorbed like that. And our body sees those as a foreign invader, and then it forms an inflammatory response. We have an immune response. And then what happens is we start to form more and more food sensitivities. And then that creates a vicious cycle that creates more inflammation in the gut, and then we form more food sensitivities, and our gut starts to get damaged. And I want to talk really specifically about the gut and either now or later on. But the gut really is such an integral part to our health, and that's really where I typically start with everybody. Because once the gut gets out of whack, then the rest of our health starts to suffer.
Certainly. Well, let's delve right into that right now then. So what is it about gut health that is so important?
So again, most of our immune system is in our GI tract. And mm-hmm. So with endometriosis, and I'll focus on that, there seems to be some immune dysregulation.
Right.
And so what I mean by that is basically the immune system gets out of whack.
Right.
So we have, an immune response, and then we have messengers that go out and calm down our immune response. And then we have different types of immune responses depending on what's invading us, depending on whether it's, an intracellular invasion, like an intracellular bacteria or virus, or an extracellular invasion, so maybe like a parasite, or a food sensitivity or something like that, that's going to activate different parts of the immune system. What happens is sometimes those should be in pretty good balance, and sometimes they'll get out of balance, but then they'll get back and rebalance. What can happen and what can cause autoimmune disease is those immune responses get out of balance, and one gets stronger than the other, and then you start to see autoimmune conditions start to develop.
Right.
And with endometriosis, we tend to see autoimmune conditions that show up along with endometriosis. And so it could be celiac disease, it could be Hashimoto's thyroiditis, it could be lupus. I mean, it could be any of those immune conditions or others. And so the idea is to try to figure out, how to rebalance the immune system. Well, what happens a lot of times is when the GI tract gets out of balance or damaged, rather, it creates what's called a leaky gut. And so usually you have cells that are pushed together nice and tight, and they create this nice tight barrier that allows things that we want to come into the gut. They'll go through the gut into the bloodstream through a receptor. And they're, it's a controlled environment. It's like a gate. And allow things that we want to go in and keep things out. Well, when that gut gets really inflamed and damaged, those nice tight junctions, those cells that are pushed nice and tightly together, they start to kind of separate, and we get what's called a leaky gut. You can kind of think of like a sieve now.
Right.
And so things are going to leak through there. It could be toxins or pathogens or foods that aren't fully digested. And the other thing is when we have this inflammation in our gut, that's typically going to trickle down and we're going to have more inflammation throughout our body.
Right.
And inflammation is the root cause of every health condition out there.
Right.
And so without autoimmune conditions, our body's doing what it's supposed to. It's forming an immune response. Our bodies are beautiful and they're so smart.
Mm-hmm.
When we get out of whack, if we have this constant attack on our immune system, or attack on our body, and our immune system just going crazy, and things start to get out of balance, then what happens is our body can start to attack itself. And usually that's going to be wherever the weak link is. So if you have a weak digestive tract, then you might, you know, develop Crohn's.
Right.
Or maybe it's you're predisposed to thyroid, so maybe it's going to attack the thyroid, or maybe it's going to attack the pancreas, and you develop type 1 diabetes. So it's going to attack where it's going to attack. You can't really
exactly. And then it goes back to what you said in the beginning. It's, you know, if you're genetically predisposed to certain things, it's that loaded gun. All of a sudden, now there's a finger on the trigger, right? So,
yeah.
Yeah, excellent. Now, we're going to start talking a little bit about specific diets. Now, we would like to remind our listeners that you're more than welcome to go ahead and call in to us and talk directly with Danielle about specific diet concerns that you have. The number, if you'd like to call in, is 323-693-3847. And you can also send me questions through the Pelvic Messenger Facebook page. So either way, you can go ahead and contact us and get your questions out there. Now, based on all this information that we've had so far about the connections with our digestive system and our GI tract, various dietary approaches have been developed to help manage some of the symptoms. So, Danielle, let's go ahead and kind of jump into some of those diets. The first being probably the most popular one that endometriosis patients hear about, and that is the endo diet. So can we talk a bit about that?
Sure. So the endo diet takes out a lot of the most common food allergens. So that being wheat, which is a gluten-containing grain, dairy, sugar, soy, red meat, and it also takes out things like alcohol and caffeine and junk food. So,
right.
So what I like about the endo diet is it does take out a lot of those common food allergens, and it does talk about taking out some of the more inflammatory foods. So when we talk about endo, we think of pain. And inflammation, and we want to keep that inflammation down as much as possible.
Right.
The endo diet recommends taking out sugar, and that's something I tell every person that walks through my door is we need to get a handle on your sugar intake and really try to limit it. Or if you really want to be really progressive and preventative, is try to eliminate it from your diet as much as possible. When you eat sugar, it instantly causes inflammation in your body. So anytime you're taking it in and you're eating it, you're causing inflammation. And
okay.
So you're gonna have more pain. So what sugar does is it causes a rise in insulin, and that's gonna cause an increase in inflammation. But the other thing is it's very inflammatory in your blood when you have high sugar. In endometriosis as well, and we see this a lot with our patients in the office, is we see a lot of insulin resistance. And insulin resistance is basically when you eat sugar or when you eat carbohydrate, it breaks down into sugar. That sugar
right.
gets released out into your bloodstream. And then that sends a message, as your sugar rises in your bloodstream, it sends a message to your pancreas to release insulin. Insulin will then go to your cells. It plugs into a receptor, another receptor comes up, and that's like a door opening.
Mm-hmm.
So I kind of think of insulin like a key that's going to open a door in our cells, and then that's going to let the sugar into our cells.
Okay.
With insulin resistance, what happens is there's something wrong with that key. So our body will release a bunch of insulin, but those keys are defective, so it can't get that door to open.
Gotcha.
And so the pancreas releases more and more insulin to try to overcome that resistance. And so we see high levels of insulin in the blood and high levels of sugar in the blood, which is very inflammatory. And so by taking sugar out and modifying our carbohydrate intake, then we can regulate those blood sugars and keep them a little bit more stable and decrease inflammation in the body. Alcohol, anytime we're drinking alcohol, it will cause an inflammatory response because it is, it's going to aggravate the gastrointestinal lining. And so, again, anytime we start messing with the gut, we're going to mess with the rest of our body. And then caffeine, again, caffeine can be more stimulatory, and I don't want to get too much into caffeine and the different arms of that immune system, but it can basically push it in one direction or another. And if you're already dominant in that one direction, then it can push it even further into that direction. And it's also a stimulant, and it also can be aggravating to the gut as well. And a lot of times we see, as far as stimulant, we see some adrenal issues. So that could be, you know, anxiety, difficulty sleeping, fatigue, and caffeine can further perpetuate that.
Right, right.
So
is it safe to say that the endo diet, then, is pretty much designed then to reduce inflammation as much as possible in the body?
Absolutely, absolutely.
Excellent.
I think it's at the off point for sure, and then if you are, you know, having a lot of food sensitivities, then you might need to take it a little bit further and do some further investigating with your foods.
Right, right. Excellent. Okay, so let's move on to the IC diet and talk about specifically how it was developed. And because I do know a lot of endometriosis patients suffer with IC, so what they've done is they've kind of taken a little bit of the endo diet and a little bit of the IC diet and kind of mixed it together. So let's kind of talk about those two a bit hand in hand.
Sure. So the IC diet is developed more to decrease the acidity of your urine coming in, going through.
Okay.
And so what it does is it takes out or recommends excluding a lot of foods that are going to cause increased acidity in your urine. So things like, you know, coffee, tea, soda, alcohol, a lot of your citrus juices like orange juice, also cranberry juice, and foods and beverages that contain artificial sweeteners, so things like Splenda or Sweet 'n Low.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people are sensitive to those. I see a lot of people, you know, with migraines. When we cut those artificial sweeteners out, their migraines go away. And hot peppers and spicy foods are taken out. And then also eliminating allergenic foods. So, again, that's going to take some investigating to figure out which foods you're allergic to. And, you know, I think as far as taking out acidic foods, it's probably not a bad idea. The thing about some of the foods on the IC diet, and I'm going to talk about the alkaline diet just for a second, is, you know, some foods can be really acidic outside of the body,
mm-hmm.
but inside of the body they're going to have more of an alkaline effect. And a good example of that would be lemons and limes.
Okay.
And so those are really acidic.
Right.
You know, it's got the same a lemon has the same pH as your stomach acid pretty much.
Oh.
So it's pretty acidic. And I actually will have people sometimes, if they have low stomach acid, I will have them have a little bit of lemon about 5-10 minutes before the meal, and then that's going to help start that digestive process because their stomach's going to be a little bit more acidic.
Right.
However, lemons are really high in things like potassium and magnesium, which alkalize the body.
Okay.
And so they actually have an alkalizing effect in the body. And so should I jump right into the alkaline diet?
Yeah, I just have one quick question from the internet before, as we've touched on it. We talked about the IC diet really stresses reducing artificial sweeteners. So just a question about that. If artificial sweeteners aren't good for us, and if sugar is also a trigger for us, is there actually a safe alternative out there that we can use to help sweeten our food?
That's a great question. Sure. You can use natural stevia. Stevia is a leaf.
Mm-hmm.
And there's one called sweet leaf that's pretty good that you can use.
Okay.
That's my go-to when I suggest to people what to use for a sweetener.
Right.
You can also, do a little bit of fruit. And use that as a sweetener. So let's say you're making a smoothie or something.
Right.
You could put, you know, like a quarter of a banana in there. Bananas are super sweet.
Right.
And
they have multiple forms of sugar in them.
Yeah. Yeah, the biggest thing is, you know, sugar really is an addictive thing. I mean, it's just as addictive as, you know, cocaine or cigarettes. And
right.
It should be a controlled substance, in my opinion. And so, you know, it has the same effect. You know, you have opioid receptors in your brain that bring pleasure, and sugar will actually light those up. And
okay.
So it's really addictive. And so when I have people that come in and we, you know, try to get them to decrease their sugar intake, it's, you know, a rough couple of days, because really they're detoxing. They're going literally going through a detox. And so but once you get through that, you don't have those sugar cravings as much. So I always think back to, you know, years back, I used to have, you know, some ice cream or some sort of dessert after dinner every single night. And you just, it's like you have this strong, strong craving for it. And if you don't have that, then you feel deprived. And but if you go maybe a week or so without having it, then all of a sudden you don't crave dessert after dinner anymore.
Right.
And it really is quite addictive.
Excellent. Okay. Well, let's move into the alkaline diet. Before we do that, you know, obviously this show is designed to educate and help our listeners. So if you have specific nutrition or diet concerns that you would like to discuss with Danielle, please give us a call. It's 323-693-3847. That is the number that you can call us at, 323-693-3847. Okay, let's talk about the alkaline diet.
Okay. So the alkaline diet is basically looking at foods affecting in the body. And so I usually give people an acid alkaline food chart that they can take a look at. And, you know, if somebody has an illness or health condition, I'll try to get them to eat about 80% alkaline and 20% acidic.
Right.
And so what it is when you're eating a diet like this, what I call the SAD diet, the standard American diet,
uh-huh.
That is very, very acidic. It has a lot of unhealthy fats in it, a lot of animal proteins, a lot of meats in it, a lot of sugar, a lot of processed foods, which create a pretty acidic environment in your body.
Right.
And when you have an acidic body, you're going to acidify that body tissue. And what that's going to do, this is theory, is that it's going to choke off the oxygen from the cells. And so if your cells can't get oxygen, that's going to do a couple things. It's going to compromise your immune system, but you also need oxygen for your body to make energy. So it's
right.
really, really important to have plenty of oxygen to make energy and for your metabolism to function properly.
Right.
And so this is going to, theoretically, it's going to lead to or promote the a lot of diseases like cancer and heart disease, diabetes, all these things where you see it an impairment in people's energy metabolism at a cellular level. It's also going to make you feel tired, because if you can't make energy, then you're going to be exhausted all the time.
Right.
So the idea is to balance out that acid-alkaline blood ratio in your body cells, and there's ways to test for that, and we can talk about that a little bit more next week, I guess.
Certainly.
Can we talk about specifically how to do some of these things?
Now, and this kind of this maybe jumps ahead to a little bit that we're going to discuss next week, but the alkaline diet, seeing it described as such, is new for me. Now, I've heard, though, of food pairing diets. So is that kind of along the same line? I know there was a lot of media hype about that a couple years ago.
Yeah. So the food pairing's a little bit different. Okay, so food pairing, the preference behind that is basically when you digest foods, as they go through the digestive tract, there's different pHs.
Right.
And so carbohydrates, proteins, and fats are going to take different pHs to be digested properly.
Okay.
So, for example, you eat protein, that means a really high acidic environment in your stomach to denature that protein, and then it's
right.
going to go down into your small intestine, where bicarbonate is going to be released, and then it's going to alkalize that environment a little bit because enzymes can't work well in an acidic environment.
Right.
And so an example of that would be when you, when you cook ceviche, and the way that you can start, you put lemon on it. You don't actually cook it. You put lemon on it, and that acid from the lemon denatures the protein and actually kind of cooks it. When you eat carbohydrates, you secrete a little bit of what's called salivary amylase in your mouth, and that starts a little bit of carbohydrate digestion. And then when that carbohydrate hits the stomach, that salivary amylase gets denatured because it's a protein. And then when it gets down into the small intestine, your pancreas secretes more what's called pancreatic amylase, and that continues the digestive process for carbohydrates. And then lipids have another process. But so the basic premise behind that is the belief is that if you eat, let's say, some fruit, which is, you know, a lot of carbohydrates, and some meat, then you're going to decrease the digestion of that meat because when you eat the carbohydrate, it's going to cause a higher pH in the stomach, and then you're not going to be able to unravel or denature that protein as well. And so the protein is going to be impaired, or the digestion is going to be impaired. The thing is, our bodies are pretty smart, and we've always eaten mixed meals, you know.
Right.
You know, since mankind was here on this earth. And so it doesn't really, I haven't seen a lot of good research on that.
Right.
With that said, I have seen people that do food combining and they feel better.
Right.
And it could be that they're cutting out certain foods. It could be that they're, maybe it is working okay for them. So I don't really say any diet is terrible and stupid unless I think it's detrimental and it's, you know, grossly deficient in certain nutrients, because everybody is so unique and different, and we're learning more and more and more that I never really poo-poo any diet.
right, no.
If someone feel better and they're not deficient in nutrients and becoming malnourished, then go for it.
Exactly. That's kind of what we stress in the various support groups online, is that, you know, everybody is different, and everybody's approach to health and wellness is going to be different. And if you stumble upon something that works really well for you, then high five, keep going with it. And, you know, don't necessarily think that what works for, you know, your friend Susie is going to work for you. You have to be willing to do the trial and error process to find a routine, whether it be through your through the drug therapy that you're using or your nutrition, that actually works for you. And although that trial and error process may be frustrating, in the long run, once you actually hit the target, it is well worth it. So totally agree with you on that one. Let's move on to the hormone diet. Before we do that, I just want to toss that phone number out there again. That's 323-693-3847. And, of course, you know, if you're friends with me on Facebook, you can go ahead and send me a direct message, or you can message right through the Pelvic Messenger page on Facebook as well. So let's talk about the hormone diet. I know there's a lot of information out there about that. In fact, I think I actually have two cookbooks in my cookbook collection that are written just based on this diet.
Mm-hmm. Oh, great. Okay. So the hormone diet, from my understanding, maybe you know more about it than I do, because you have the cookbooks at home, there's different phases of it. So it starts off as a detox phase. And let me back up for a second. The premise of it is to balance your hormones.
Right.
And so if your hormones are out of balance, the thought is that's going to affect your general health in general, but it's also going to affect your thyroid, your adrenals, your endometriosis, and inflammation in your body.
Right.
And so it's all about rebalancing your hormones with diet. And so as far as the phases go, it starts off with a detox phase, and that eliminates all your gluten-containing grains, so things like wheat and rye and tricale and probably forgetting some. I know, and barley.
Right.
And then it also takes out a lot of the meats and things. So what it does allow is gluten-free grains, vegetables. It takes out corn, which is a common allergen. Fruits, takes out citrus, which is a common allergen, all canned fruits and dried fruits. It allows nuts and seeds, fish, meats, feta, goat cheese, olives, avocado, flaxseed, canola oil, eggs, non-dairy, milk, and soy products. And that's it.
Right.
So, and I said it eliminated meat, but it allows meat. So what it is it is based, it's kind of like a modified elimination diet.
Okay.
And so with that said, kind of like with the endo diet is, you know, if you're allergic to corn, let's say, every time you eat corn, your body's going to be having an immune response, which is going to cause inflammation in your body. And if you're, and when you have inflammation in your body, that's going to affect your hormones. So that's going to affect your adrenal, a whole bunch of cortisol, which is going to raise your blood sugars, which is going to affect your thyroid hormone production, which is going to affect your hormone production of estrogen and progesterone and testosterone and DHEA. And I'm more than happy to kind of go through that whole, what's called HPA axis,
mm-hmm.
and how that all gets affected. But so basically it's going to throw everything out of whack when you eat something that you're allergic to.
Right.
The other thing it's going to do is when you have these high cortisol levels is that causes fluid retention. And so by taking out a lot of these common allergens, you're going to have, and I know a lot of people go on this to lose weight, you're going to have a lot of fluid loss. You're going to have a lot of water weight loss in that initial stage. The other thing this diet is, it's a very low carbohydrate diet and low glycemic index diet. So but what I mean by the glycemic index is basically it's when you eat a food, it looks at how fast it raises your blood sugars after that food that you eat.
Right.
And so if you eat a food that's lower than the glycemic index, let's say like nuts, you're going to have a very small rise in blood sugars. Versus if you eat a piece of, you know, Wonder Bread, for example, or white bread, that's going to raise your blood sugars really quickly.
Right.
So it's going to be helping to establish a better insulin response and also modify your blood sugar response and keep kind of a nice even keel for your blood sugars. So that's kind of a nice thing too about this.
Excellent. Okay, so we touched on before the GMO, the non-GMO diets. So let's kind of move into that because I know, you know, everybody's seeing that information coming up to us through the media about the various, protests against GMO. So let's talk about this whole can of worms, if you will.
Yeah. So GMOs are interesting. Basically what we're doing is we're taking genes from one thing, a lot of times it's a bacteria, and we're implanting it into seeds, into a food, and with the idea for that food to be resistant from different insects. And so the idea is that you don't have to use as many pesticides, and you're not going to lose those crops to insects and pests. So GMOs, though, what we found is some of these bacteria that they're taking out, they're actually affecting our health. And we have seen a rise in a lot of GI conditions, obesity, diabetes, since we started using genetically modified organisms in our food industry. And so one of the things, there's a really, really good documentary out there called Genetic Roulette. And that's got some great information, and I think it's pretty well done. It's easy to understand. I could understand it okay, so it's got to be pretty easy to understand. And so what they found is, you know, these GMOs, this bacteria, is actually changing the delicate balance of bacteria that we have in our gut, and we're actually implanting bacteria that wasn't once a habitant in our gut into our gut. And so it's, I think of that bacteria in your gut is you've got some friendly bacteria in there and you've got some unfriendly bacteria in there. And they're all in competition for food. And so if you have more of this unfriendly bacteria in there, it's going to crowd out and it's going to take away the food supply from that good bacteria that's doing all these beneficial things to our body, like improving our immune system and deriving adequate calories, not too many calories, and it's repairing things, and it's doing a whole bunch of stuff that to help the health of our body. And then we're putting in other bacteria that might be causing damage to our gut or mm-hmm. causing damage to our immune system. And so with they're finding that with what's called the BT toxin, and that's one of the things they'll actually implant in there, into especially corn. And so what they've shown in animal studies is when you make sausage, you use the intestinal lining of cows to wrap around that meat and make a sausage. That's the outer casing. Well, we can't use the intestinal lining from cows that have been fed genetically modified corn and soy, because when we go to pull out the stomach, it all just shreds and tears apart.
Right.
And so it doesn't stay intact anymore. So it's actually poking. What the BT toxin does is it pokes holes in the intestines of the insects that eat it. And that's how it works. And so that's how it kills the pest. And so when we ingest that corn, the thinking is that it's actually poking holes in our stomach. And when I talked about the gut and that importance of that healthy intestinal lining, that could be a problem.
Right.
And so so trying to avoid, what I definitely recommend people to do is try to avoid the foods that have, we know, have been highly genetically modified.
Right.
And so foods that have been genetically modified that we know of are soybeans, corn, rapeseed or canola oil, sugar beets. So anything that says sugar, unless it says cane sugar or anything different, it's probably sugar beet or high fructose corn syrup. Cotton, so that might be an ingredient in vegetable oil or margarine. Dairy, so with growth hormone. And also they might have been fed genetically modified grains or alfalfa.
Right.
And papayas from Hawaii, zucchini, not all zucchini, but just assume most of them. And then when you're eating processed foods, so you have to be looking for things even like cornstarch or sugar or canola oil, or soy, which they put in everything. And so, again, this goes back to the more food you can eat that's natural and less processed, the better off you are.
Right.
So I try to keep it really simple. Like, if your great-grandmother wouldn't recognize the food that you're about to put in your mouth, you might want to think twice about it.
Good advice, for sure, for sure. Excellent. Okay, so let's talk about, so staying on the GMO thing here. You know, there's a whole wave now of people trying to eat more organic. So is the organic option going to be the best one for people that, you know, either have endometriosis or have autoimmune issues, or is that just kind of a whole lot of hype? That's a question that's coming from us from the internet.
If you go on to, I think it's Environmental Working Group, they have a great little shopping list for GMOs.
Okay.
But the other thing is, if you look up the Dirty Dozen and the Clean 15,
right.
So if you're on a budget, I mean, it's best to eat most things organic. And the whole thing with organic foods is it's really about the soil quality.
Okay.
And that's the whole, when you talk to an organic farmer, it's all about the soil, like having good, rich, nutrient-rich soil.
Right.
And so the food's going to actually taste better. So when I have somebody that tells me they don't like vegetables, I'll say, okay, well, let me make you some vegetables. And when you give them organic vegetables that are cooked correctly and or even raw, and maybe you can disguise them a little bit with some herbs or some things like that. And then all of a sudden, people like vegetables.
Right.
We need those vegetables that are devoid of lots of nutrients and have traveled, across the United States, and by the time they get to you, they're a week or two old. They don't have a whole lot of taste, and I probably wouldn't like vegetables either. And so as far as eating organic, there's certain fruits and vegetables that are going to be more heavily sprayed with pesticides. If they're organic, there should be non-GMO. There is some debate about that, and I'm not going to go too much into that because sometimes when a farmer buys food, they won't know that it's a GMO seed. They're not supposed to be getting GMO seeds because usually if you're growing stuff, you have to have rights from Monsanto, but they can't intentionally be buying GMO seeds and advertising it as organic, put it that way.
Right.
So what I usually tell people is if you do have access, I mean, we're so blessed out here in California, we have a farmer's market almost every day.
Mm-hmm.
But the more you can buy local, whatever food you can grow on your own, even in window boxes, better. And then getting the organic foods, at least from the Dirty Dozen, so things like apples and strawberries and lettuce and kale and things like that, those are going to have more pesticides on them, and so it's better to get those organic.
Right.
And then if you're on a budget, the Clean 15, those are the ones that have the least amount of pesticides, like avocados and bananas and things like that, you can get away with getting those not organic.
Excellent. Okay, so reminder to our listeners, go ahead, click onto Google and search out the Clean 15 and the Dirty Dozen, and you might just be shocked to see what you're going to find there. Let's move on to a couple of the other diets that we touched on a little bit earlier. One was the Candida diet.
Yeah, the Candida diet is basically to help to starve off what's called Candida albicans, which is a yeast that can overgrow in your intestines.
Okay.
And there is a very tight link between Candida and endometriosis.
Oh,
and
okay.
And there's ways to test for Candida. You can do stool studies. You can look at organic acids. And I do a lot of that testing in our office, especially if somebody has symptoms of Candida. Maybe they get yeast infections a lot. Maybe they have a lot of sinus issues. Maybe they get a lot of UTIs. They have a lot of bloating. They're fatigued a lot of brain fog. There's different things out there. Maybe they have a thick white coating on their tongue. So a Candida diet basically is a very, very low, low, low carbohydrate diet.
Okay.
Different Candida diets out there. There's Candida diets that are a little bit more strict. They basically take out all carbohydrates. No fruits, no starchy vegetables, no grains at all. And then there's more kind of liberalized Candida diets. I tend to steer that way a little bit more because the thing about Candida is it grows roots into your intestines, and the more you starve it, the deeper it'll grow those roots looking for food.
Oh, interesting.
And so I usually do a little bit of a modified. We still do low sugar, but do a little bit of, carbohydrate in complex forms. So maybe a small amount of grains, some beans or lentils or, things like that, and spread them out throughout the day. So we're helping to control blood sugars as well as not giving it too much food at once.
Right.
And then we use antifungals and herbs and rotate those to kill it and do it that way. And also stress reduction is so important for that. And maybe next week we can talk more about lifestyle stuff as far as stress reduction and the immune system and repairing the gut. So, so critical and important.
Certainly, certainly. That's, next week is all about taking this information and putting it together in a way that we can actually apply it to our life and our everyday, eating habits. So for sure we can go ahead and take a look at that then. Let's talk a little bit about the elimination diet.
So the elimination diet is just cutting out the most common food allergens. Usually I'll do a 30-day elimination diet, and then what we'll do is we'll introduce each one of those foods that we cut out one at a time, and then wait like 3 days and see if they have any adverse reactions. So maybe they have more stuffiness or fatigue or joint aches or pain or foggy headedness and sleep disturbances. So it's looking at foods that they're sensitive to. You can test for food sensitivities with IgG immune response. However, in my opinion, you're testing more for leaky gut.
Okay.
And less for true food sensitivities. If somebody has multiple food sensitivities in an IgG test, I just know, okay, you have leaky gut.
Right.
So we need to repair your gut.
And what does an IgG test involve?
It's a blood test.
Okay.
It'll just look at your response to different foods, your immune response.
Interesting. Relating to that, I have a question from the internet about detoxing or removing a food from your diet. What is the best suggested time frame that you actually do that? This person's been told a couple of days to a couple of weeks.
Right. Well, it takes a little while for the immune system to calm down, so I usually do a minimum of 2 weeks of removing the foods. The other thing, too, is if you remove one food at a time, let's say, okay, I'm going to try to eliminate soy.
Right.
But you're still eating gluten and dairy, and maybe you're reacting to those. You're not going to see any resolution in your symptoms if you only take out soy.
Right.
And so if you use a full elimination diet, hopefully you're going to be able to see a difference in your symptoms if foods are what's causing the problem. So you're going to take out things like red meat, soy, corn, dairy, gluten, citrus, chocolate. So a lot of these peanuts, a lot of these most common food allergens, and then we're going to reintroduce one at a time and see if we see any change in your health and how you're feeling. And I have a big thick packet that I give people that gives them a shopping list and a 7-day menu plan and recipes, because it's hard to do.
Right.
It's really difficult. I mean, it's a big change to most people, and it's not easy. So, you know, as much guidance as I can give them, and then just, you know, send them good thoughts to stick with. And as far as, you know, the detoxifying portion of it, you know, there's things that are important to make sure that you're not feeling terrible. You know, when you do a candida diet, a lot of times people will tell me that they feel awful for like 3 or 4 days. And what happens is when you kill that candida, a lot of those toxins get released.
Mm-hmm.
And so our liver has to dispose of those toxins and get rid of them. And with endometriosis, we do see a little bit of almost a depressed detox system. And so, you know, there's two phases of detox in the liver where most of our detoxification is taking place. This first phase will take really toxic substances and it'll make it into less toxic substances, and also it'll create some free radicals, which can be damaging to the cells. And so in this first phase of detoxification, it uses a lot of antioxidants and amino acids. And then in that second phase of detoxification, it's going to take those kind of byproducts from that or end products from the first phase, and it's going to further detoxify them, and then we're going to get rid of those products. And so that second phase is really relying again on protein and a lot of different vitamins and minerals, as well as sulfur. A lot of our sulfur-containing vegetables are helpful with that. For cruciferous vegetables like broccoli and kale and cauliflower, these things help to increase what's called glutathione. And glutathione is a really, really strong antioxidant and a key component or a key player in that second phase of detoxification. So some people don't make enough glutathione for one reason or another. And so we can kind of upregulate that. And the other thing I want to mention about detox, specifically to endometriosis, is in our liver, we detoxify and break down estrogen.
Mm-hmm.
And then what we do is we put it into our bile, and it goes out into our intestinal tract when we eat, and then hopefully we it binds to fiber and we poop it out. So really important to have plenty of fiber in the diet and also have a well-functioning detoxification system in our liver. And right. So, you know, getting plenty of fruits and vegetables and antioxidants and, adequate protein in our diet and different building blocks to help kind of support that detoxification.
Right.
Really, really important.
Excellent. Okay, so let's talk a little bit about anti-inflammatory diets.
Okay. Anti-inflammatory diet is taking out foods that are going to be inflammatory. So those are going to be a lot of our damaged fats, like hydrogenated fats and a lot of animal fats, and taking sugar, taking out food additives like different chemicals and food colorings, artificial sweeteners, providing our body with plenty of water to detoxify and rinse itself, and then eating foods that are going to help to decrease inflammation. So, you know, different herbs and spices like turmeric and cinnamon and fish oils and let's see what else, garlic and cilantro and all these, you know, foods. And the way I think about foods and diet is anything I'm putting in my mouth, I try to think of it as, okay, this, my cabinets in my refrigerator in my kitchen is kind of like my apothecary.
Right.
And so whatever I'm eating, it's either going to be healing my body or it's going to be damaging my body or working against me. And so anything I put in my mouth, I want it to be healing my body.
Right.
And so I'll actually sit down before a meal and say to my food, okay, please help this food to heal my body and nourish my body and help my body to accept the food and take it in and do what it needs to do. And then I eat my meal. And thinking about food as that, as such, as something that can be something in your toolkit to heal your body and feel better.
Right.
And so, and that's all the anti-inflammatory diet is. It's trying to put foods in that are going to be more healing and decrease inflammation in your body.
So basically just being nice to ourselves.
Exactly, yeah. Loving and kind, exactly.
That is excellent.
Yeah.
Danielle, was there any other points that you wanted to make in this phase of this discussion about nutrition and the importance of it before we move on to outlining what our listeners can expect for next week?
The one last thing I want to say is just about food in general. It kind of goes hand in hand with that last comment I said, but basically, you know, our food is made up of a whole bunch of chemicals, and our body is full of a whole bunch of chemicals and different chemical reactions. And so what we eat is actually, it's communicating to the cells in our body, and it's more than just something that tastes good. Hopefully it should taste good too. You should enjoy your food. I don't want to. It's having an actual chemical response in the body. And so, you know, whatever we're putting things in our body, we want to make sure that we're turning on the right genes. You know, when we talk about epigenetics, we're turning on things that we want to turn on and keeping things shut off that we want to keep shut off.
Right.
So we're putting the right things into our body. And everybody's different. So it's really getting down to your individual needs. And then there's some general stuff, which we talked a little bit about already.
Right. Excellent. Okay, so then moving on to next week's show, you know, this, when we were originally sat down to brainstorm how we were going to approach this, we realized that this was, you know, an enormous topic, that there are so many different ways that our diet actually affects our overall well-being. So our approach to this show was to kind of come into the first episode and give you a little bit of science-based information and kind of a rundown of the different diets and options that are out there and how those work with your body. And then next week, actually bring to you some tools to figure out how it is that you actually implement these changes into your day-to-day life. Now, I know talking in the various support groups online, you know, we are creatures of habit, and sometimes making these lifestyle changes are really, really, really tough. I am myself an absolute foodie. I love to cook. I love to experiment with things. And I must say, this adventure into being more selective with my diet and eating for my endo has actually become a bit of fun for me, because it's a challenge. I'll take an ordinary cookbook and then figure out what it is that I can do to modify those recipes so that they're actually kind to my body. So those type of things are the things that we're going to start talking about next week, about how to actually take these changes that we know logically are going to help us and practically apply them to our lifestyles. Danielle, is there any kind of homework that you would suggest that our listeners do before they tune in next week?
Yeah, I would just maybe think about, you know, what kind of foods you like to eat and what are your food triggers, you know, things that your go-to foods when you're upset, and start thinking about, because a lot of us are emotional eaters.
Right.
You know, there's things that you're eating just to make you feel better, you know, and start thinking about how you eat. Do you eat for emotion? Do you eat for, you don't know what else to eat and you're scared to eat because you have digestive issues? Do you, so how are you eating? And when you eat those foods, how does it make you feel? You know, both physically and emotionally.
Right.
And then also kind of what are your challenges to, maybe if you do feel that you need to make some dietary changes, what kind of obstacles are there for you? And what might you need, and maybe you don't have these answers, but what are some of the things you might need to do to overcome those? Like, I know personally I'm a terrible food jagger. And what I mean by that is I would be happy eating the same thing every day at almost every meal. With some variation until I get sick of it, and then I'll go on to the next.
Right.
Because, you know, I got out of it, and I might really like how that food tastes. And so I might, you know, have a couple things that I just food jag on. And so, you know, one of my challenges is mixing it up, which
is
important. So.
Yeah, I think that is so true, especially when you're first coming into these new diets and you know that there's specific foods or recipes that are safe, and then you kind of get stuck in a lull. And, I've been there myself, so I totally understand what you say. Basically, next week we want to reiterate that we're going to try to help you with some tools, kind of discourage the idea that the word diet is a nasty four-letter word. We can have some options in what we're doing to help us with our health, but at the same time, just shopping by some basic guidelines is going to help us with our overall health and well-being a great deal. So until next week, we will sign off and remind everybody that they can go on to the Blog Talk Radio website under the Public Messenger tab, and you will see the details for the May 15th show. And thank you so much for Danielle giving us your time today and your expertise. We really appreciate that, and we're looking forward to learning more from you next week.
Great. I'm looking forward to it. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. All right, listeners, we will close off this show today. And again, tune in next week, May 15th, for part two of Nutrition for Endometriosis. Thank you so much. Have a great day.
Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered Chumbacasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby, mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa, take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to ChumbaCasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. ChumbaCasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.